Ron and I both went to the set, and so we saw the prop masters took us around, and they showed us Muse's lair and like everything they had designed and how careful they were to adhere to the things that we had laid out in the comic, which isn't always the case, you know?
Hey, welcome back to the Screen Crush Crossover Universe podcast. I'm the luckiest podcast host ever because I get to be here with my co-host, Heather Antos.
And I am the even luckier podcast host possible with my co-host. I don't know. That's not English. Ryan Airy.
Really good to see you. Comic-Con, are you recovered yet? It was 2 days ago it ended.
Clearly not. Clearly not, because I can't speak correctly yet.
I know talk words with mouth.
Correct.
That's
exactly.
Pretty much where I'm at right now. Yeah. Plus, we had our live show the same weekend, which was so much fun.
Gosh.
Probably the best live show we've done.
Yeah.
I can't resist. I changed a bunch of it. We wrote this whole sketch about James Gunn in it, where I'm in a dreamscape and I meet 2008 James Gunn. And he's like, I'm about to use this new app called Twitter. And then James Gunn from 2020 comes on and says, wait, don't do that. It's going to ruin your life. But then 2025, James Gunn comes in and says, oh, wait, you can do that. Everything works out great. And then James Gunn from 2027 comes on and says, it's post-apocalyptic times. We have to, like, fix the Earth. And I'm just like, what about Doomsday? Was it any good? How about Secret Wars? What happens? So that was really fun. The whole team got to be involved. But the live show was great. And I'm glad to take a rest from it for a while.
Yeah. I remember I got to be James Gunn in that show.
And we switched it up. Because you basically set the bar so high, we couldn't do the same bit anymore.
I do a mean James Gunn.
You really do. You really do.
This is true.
I can't wait. Can we just get started?
We can.
This guest. Tell us about this guest.
Yeah. So I am so stoked for our guest today. Our guest is a New York-based number one New York Times bestselling novelist, comic book writer, musician, also former attorney. You know his work from DC, from Marvel, Star Wars, all his creator-owned stuff. He's written Daredevil, She-Hulk, Death of Wolverine, Poe Dameron, Darth Vader, Lando, 8 Billion Genies, Curse Words. It goes on and on and on and on. I'm so stoked to bring Charles Soule onto the podcast today.
Hey, guys.
I can't believe I get to talk to Charles Soule right now. Just massive fan. I know we met a second ago and I was like, hi, nice to meet you. But no, really, I'm nerding out right now.
It's real now.
I saved it for the camera. Unbelievable to see you. Thank you so much for coming on.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much, both of you, for having me. Heather, I've known you for a long time, which has been awesome. And Ryan, it's a pleasure to meet you today. This is great.
Yeah, man. We talk about your books when we do Star Wars coverage, because, you know, in our Easter egg videos, we always get into, like, the deeper lore, especially during the Acolyte and Kyber Crystal bleeding. Like, we were basically quoting, you know, Vader, that first arc, all the way. It's just so good. It's you're such great writers. Nice to meet you.
Oh!
Thank you very much. It is fun.
What are you watching right now? What's going on in your pop culture life?
Well, you know, I don't have as much time for any of that as I would like, because I'm always writing. Like, you know, Heather's list of titles that I've worked on is like, I don't know, a quarter of it. Like, one of the things that I am sort of known for in the business is how much I do, how prolific I am. And so because of that, I don't get to watch as much stuff as I want to, but I will say that I made time for Alien Earth recently, which I thought was a really interesting take on that mythos, which is one of my favorites of all time. So I really am glad that I could find time for those eight episodes, I think.
Yeah.
And I thought they did a really, really great job of just playing with the tools and the pieces and remixing them in interesting ways. I was very impressed with it. What else have I been watching? I finished season two of Peacemaker, which is a show that I've been, you know, I heard you guys talking about James Gunn before I came on, and you know, he's been a part of my sort of creative sphere for a long time, because I am good friends with a guy named Andy Diemer, who comes out of Troma. You know, Troma Films.
So I used to work at Troma.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Yeah. So Andy was one of the producers on Poltergeist.
Oh, nice. Poultrygeist.
Poultry, like chickens.
Yeah.
It's The Night of the Chicken Dead is the subtitle.
Right.
And so he did that. But before he did that, he worked on James with on Romeo and Juliet. So James has been like, I've not met him, but he's always been one degree away from me for a long time. And so it's been really interesting to have been hearing his name way back then and then just see this ascent and, you know, how well I think he's using his, you know, nerd space credibility to tell these really interesting stories with these characters. So I think the DCU is in really good hands right now. It's great.
Yeah, and stories we never thought we would get, like Salvation Run. Who would have thought we'd be setting that up? I'm pretty excited about that.
Yep. That, I think the, you know, everything we're seeing in the in Superman, Supergirl, like interesting takes, like I'm super jazzed for Lanterns. I think that's the Green Lantern take I wanted for a long time from what I've heard and seen and what we've all sort of seen about it. I only know a tiny bit more than most people do, but it just sounds fantastic. So I'm legitimately excited to see what kind of stories come out of the DC. What is it? It's not DC. Whatever the heck they call.
Yeah, they're not calling it the DCU anymore.
Oh, they're not?
Unless they are, I don't know.
I got a lot of tags and titles to change then. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, whatever it is, I'm excited for the next project. And I'm happy to that it's proceeding the way that it is. It's great.
It is exciting to, I think, see the bulk of the fan base of you know, the comic book movie fan base be excited about DC movies again. I think there definitely was a period there where, you know, and with the Marvel films too, right? A little bit of a superhero burnout we've talked about on the channel a lot, Ryan. And I think James Gunn coming in right now with Superman and Superman hitting the way it did, it definitely has, alongside Fantastic Four, right? Both movies being very different tonally than what we've been seeing recently from either studio. It's been really exciting to get that sort of like breath of life back in the spaces.
Yeah, I'm with you though. It's hard to find time to watch stuff, but yeah, there's so much out there to good content.
That's all you do, Ryan. All you do is
I know,
watch stuff.
I know.
But it's not for fun. It's for work.
A cursed job, I know. Dream job. It's like a Twilight Zone wish.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, Charles, we have to start at, I think, you know, at the very beginning for us where we started working together and probably, you know, some of the stuff you're most known for these days, which is your work on Star Wars. You've been a creative consultant for Lucasfilm. You are one of the founding architects of the High Republic, which I didn't mention previously in your bio, but obviously anyone who knows, there's a lot. There was too much to list in that bio, but everything from The Light of the Jedi, which kicked it all off, originally.
Oh, great book. Great book.
Talk a little bit about your journey from going from that first miniseries, Lando, right? Where Lando stole Emperor Palpatine's ship. And what it's been like to get from to here.
So I've been a huge Star Wars fan since I was a little kid. It was one of the first, I think it was the first sort of pop culture mythology that grabbed me. And so, you know, we're talking, you know, very, very little Charles running around in the backyard with a stick, pretending it's a lightsaber, you know, like smashing his brothers and sister over the head with that stick, you know, like just the things that you do when you're a kid, and the Star Wars, the story, that the power of it just grabs you, the Force, trying to use the Force to like open the door from across the room, all the things that kids do. I was doing all that, and that continued as I got older with the films, and then with the little tiny bits and pieces of Star Wars content we got from video games to, you know, Tim Zahn's trilogy, to just, you know, the things that were there. There wasn't a lot. You had to kind of find your way through the Star Wars. You kind of almost had to make your own Star Wars stories. And then we had the prequels and so on and so forth. And then obviously Disney bought Lucasfilm back in 2014, I think. It must have been earlier than that. It was 2012, I think. Because the first Star Wars stories started coming out from Marvel again in 2014, and it takes some time to put all that stuff together. The very first Star Wars story I did was called Lando, as you pointed out, Heather. I'm sure you remember it. And I worked on it with Alex Maleev and Paul Mounce. Alex Maleev was the artist, Paul Mounce was the colorist. And when Jordan White, who I'm sure you also remember, Heather, was the sort of the lead editor at Marvel, who was running the Star Wars office at the time, came to me and said, you know, is there something you would like to work on for Star Wars? I had two pitches, and one was an Emperor Palpatine pitch and the other was a Lando pitch. And the sort of the brain trust of Lucasfilm Story Group went with the Lando pitch. And so I was I'm just like, I remember what that felt like and what that moment was for me, like realizing that I was going to get to tell a story within this mythology that has always meant so, so, so much to me. And I just did whatever I do, or what I always do whenever I get one of these sort of personally game-changing assignments for me. And whether that's Swamp Thing at DC, whether it's Daredevil at Marvel, whether it's Death of Wolverine, whether it's Lando for the Star Wars office, I try to knock it out of the park. I try to write the absolute best thing I can, because I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to do anything like this again. And so I just want to be able to say, when all is said and done, that I did the absolute best I could at that time with the writer I was at the time, and so on and so forth. And so I made all these choices in that story that to me were like the best choice, the coolest choice, the thing that was like, they'll never let me do this. And then there are a lot of things they didn't let me do, but there are many things that they did that seemed to catch the eye. I don't know what it was, the Star Wars voice, the way that I treated the characters, I'm not sure, but whatever it was caught the eye of the folks at Lucasfilm and the Star Wars office at Marvel, and they asked me to write another series about Obi-Wan and Anakin, and then another series about Poe Dameron, and then another series about Darth Vader. And that Darth Vader series in particular was the one that really sort of, you know, I was doing very well to have three Star Wars series in a row at Marvel, but then the Darth Vader one was what seemed to put me into sort of this A-list category of Star Wars writers. And that's when I was approached to, shortly after, I think it was during that run, shortly after that run, that I was approached to be one of the lead architects for the High Republic by Lucasfilm publishing executive Mike Seglain. It was a name that Star Wars publishing fans have heard a lot in the last 10 years, probably, and rightly so. He's pretty amazing. But he invited me, Justina Ireland, Claudia Gray, Kevin Scott, and Daniel Jose Older to go to Skywalker Ranch and make up our own new chunk of Star Wars, which... like, that's what we were told on day one, basically. Okay, like, what do you guys want to do? And I had been in, like, story-breaking meetings with, you know, Marvel summits and things like that, where you talk about the next year and a half or so of superhero storytelling. But this was very different. For one thing, it was at Skywalker Ranch, which is one of the great, like, nerddom pilgrimage sites. And it's everything you've ever heard or imagine it would be. It is staggeringly special to be to be there at all, because it's very hard to get to Skywalker Ranch in at all. You need to kind of have a project or a profile that will let you be there. And so just walking through those, or driving, I was driven through the gates, but whatever.
It's funny. I picture being lifted by helicopter, like the cast of Lord of the Rings. When you say it's hard to get to, I picture some sort of impassable field around it.
Use an X-wing.
It's north of San Francisco. So you leave, generally speaking, you fly to San Francisco, and then most of the time you go to the Lucasfilm offices to like check it out and hang out a little bit. And then you take a van or a car up from the Presidio in San Francisco across the Golden Gate Bridge, and then you just head north into like wine country. And that is where Skywalker Ranch is. So it's like a car ride. It's not like it's impossible to get to, but you, like, people can't just go. You know, you need to sort of like get an invite, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're there, we're making up the High Republic, and then it became this really, like, it was very much like a family, the five of us, and really the six of us with Mike, and then Story Group and Lucasfilm. Like, the way that everybody got behind it was unprecedented, especially for a franchise like Star Wars, which is very particular about the stories it tells and the way it tells them and the time frames it tells them and who tells them and what kind of people tell them and all those things. Those are all elements that are very carefully considered. And so the idea that we really did have, you know, there were guidelines, there were rules, but basically we got to make it up the way we wanted to and make it as inclusive and powerful and thoughtful and emotional and hopeful, and everything that we wanted to do, we were able to put into that project. And now it launched in 2021 with my novel Light of the Jedi. It concluded in 2025 with my novel Trials of the Jedi, which was really, really cool to be able to bookend it like that. It's had, you know, dozens and dozens of published projects over that time. It was a huge part of the Acolyte TV show. It was the setting for the Young Jedi Adventures show. It's been in a bunch of video games, animation, like, it's all over the place. And we did that just from that, you know, that day at Skywalker Ranch. It was more work than that, but like
one day.
No, one day, all done.
Oh my God, that's like that famous Pixar lunch where they worked out like five of the best Pixar movies.
I think one of the things that's so cool to me about the High Republic, because, you know, this happens all the time in any franchise, right? Where it's like we create a bunch of new characters, we create a new setting, and we hope it hits. From a licensing side, as I work with a lot of licensors, and you do too, Charles, like, I totally understand why a licensor wants you to create all new characters in all new world. It's less for them to deal with while they, you know, play with their toys on TV, film, whatever. But like the High Republic hit, like it stuck the landing and then some.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was definitely one of those we put, you know, Lucasfilm, Disney, Marvel, Dark Horse, like all the publishers, everyone all involved, right? Put everything all in this moment. And it truly became a movement in the Star Wars fandom, which is wild, because I know when this started, it was originally just publishing. Mm-hmm. There was hope that maybe TV would happen or video games or whatever, but like that was never the plan.
Right. It was, as you said, it started as explicitly as a publishing first initiative. It caught on. Like the thing that's interesting about it, and I think we almost benefited from this, which is a kind of a rough thing to think about, but it launched in the pandemic. It launched in January of 2021, which is when everybody was at home still. It was still lockdown. And people had disposable income because they sort of weren't doing some of the things that they used to be doing. Their, you know, stipends, just all of that was kind of in the mix. And there wasn't a lot of new content because things couldn't be filmed. Like, yada, yada, yada. All these sort of dominoes lined up to create a situation where people were really excited to get new Star Wars content. And were able to access it in a way like, you know, people had time to read. So we landed really, really hard. You know, the numbers were there. Like, we got the numbers. We were thrilled. Like you mentioned in the intro, but like the Light of the Jedi debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, which is one of those things, like when you get into writing, when you get into being a novelist, you're like, that's one of the premier goals is that. And so the fact that High Republic was able to give that to me is always going to be really meaningful. But we didn't know really what it was until we went to Star Wars Celebration in Anaheim, which was the first Star Wars Celebration to be back on after the, you know, after the pandemic. I think this was 22. And then because there was one in London in 23, and then it was off in 24, and then there's Japan in 25. So this was 2022. And there are two main stages at the at Star Wars Celebration. One is the mega, they have like Star Wars names. One is like the you know, hyperspace stage, and then there's one that's the galaxy stage and like that. So we were in the second largest of those rooms, which was a 5,000 person room. And we go in and we didn't know what to expect. We were hopeful that there would be some people there. We'd get some nice reaction. It was packed, standing room only, full of cosplayers. They treated us like we might as well have been, you know, Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill walking into that room. And that's when we knew. Like, that's when we knew what we had done, really. That's the impact of that, the sort of rush of joy from the fans at what we had done and seeing us and being able to celebrate with us was really incredible. So, and it's continued. I mean, we just finished it, so it's very bittersweet that like it wrapped up in June. And we all miss it. Like, there's the original five creators expanded out to 10 plus one. I ended up doing a children's picture book with my daughter. So Rosie is absolutely one of the High Republic authors.
She's canon.
Yeah, it's great. Exactly. So now we're all just kind of circling around, and like it's weird to not have this project that we worked on for 7 years, some of us, but it's okay.
Well, can I ask, there's a specific moment in the first book that I always think about, and in terms of like how you and the team expanded the lore of the Jedi. There's a moment, I think it's Bell Zedifar, he's falling through the air and he wraps a woman up in his cloak, is that correct? It's Bell. Okay.
Yeah, it's Bell.
And this is, I've read and seen a lot of Star Wars, I examine it for a living, it's really hard to give me chills, but you gave me chills in that moment, because the woman can't hear him. The air is rushing past them. And he just points to his Jedi crest. And the way he wrote it was, he felt the calm take over her because she knew she was with a Jedi and she was safe. Even saying it right now and doing a bad job paraphrasing it, it hits to what the Jedi were at their height.
Yep.
So you guys added so much lore, Wayseekers, all these incredible things, the dark side, Jedi can have sex, all these other things.
Incredible things.
Imprint the Jedi together.
No, of course. It's a big deal. Yeah.
Did you personally feel like maybe the prequels didn't show the Jedi at their height and that maybe they'd already caught them on the decline? And that's what you guys were going for in that story.
I mean, it is certainly not my job to
I mean, George Lucas gave us an extraordinary amount. Like, he's the template, right? Everything comes from the stuff that he did. And I know sometimes that can sound like vaguely culty or whatever, but it is true. Like, none of it would be there without him and his collaborators, Lynn Bracken, you know, like the people that he worked with to make the original trilogy and then the prequels. So what we wanted to do was show the Jedi Order at its height, untainted by the Sith.
Mm.
One of the through lines that is very clear in the prequel trilogy is that the Sith were active and were actively pulling down the Jedi, and in lots of different ways, both sort of directly, like, you know, with red lightsabers and things like that, but also in ways that just made it very difficult for them to operate, like tying them up in bureaucracy, you know, twisting the tools of government against them. And the Jedi are not a governmental organization. They're separate, but at the same time, you know, they rely on the Republic for support and things that they need and you know, all kinds of things. The Republic and the Jedi Order are very linked. And so when you have this darkness that is pulling at them, it's whether they know, I mean, they didn't really know it, but whether you know it or not, something that's taking your focus away from your primary goals is going to make you less effective at your primary goals. And so it was not our Jedi and High Republic are just like cooler and better. It was just they were, I don't mean that way. Yeah, of course. Yeah, but they were under a different set of pressures, you know, and we saw what we thought would be really interesting in the High Republic was to take an order that was like that basically had been at peace, was deeply respected, was very well known, even if there aren't that many of them. Everybody knew what that symbol meant, you know, like what the Jedi Order symbol means. And if a Jedi is around, you can just feel safe and protected and know that like things are going to be on track. And like, even if things are bad, things will get better, which I don't know that's exactly what the Jedi Order meant in the prequels to the same degree. I think it did. I think it absolutely still did. By the end of it, like a lot of what Palpatine tried to do in the prequel trilogy was to get the public distrusting the Order so that when he made that announcement that the Jedi are traitors, people would buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that people would have bought it during the High Republic. Like, I don't think that announcement could have been made and landed the same way as it did.
Well, definitely not. And in the Clone Wars, that we hear characters blame the Jedi for the war and all these other things that kind of led up to the announcement Revenge of the Sith.
Mm-hmm.
That's excellent.
Absolutely. So there you go.
Oh, man. Now, as much as I think we could both sit and talk Star Wars with you.
And will. No, we don't have to just talk Star Wars. I'm over here with a list this big. I want to pull out a question.
Yeah, I mean, it would be remiss not to mention your work on Daredevil, especially with the show that just came out this year, right? I mean, the Daredevil Born Again show, like, definitely leaned very heavily on a lot of your run.
Yeah.
Kingpin, Mayor of New York, Muse, of course. Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes with these things, the creators don't always get the heads up that their stuff is appearing or will be leaned on, you know, for MCU or other things. Were you aware that how much they were going to be leaning on your work for this run?
You know, it's interesting because of the way that Daredevil Born Again Season 1 sort of came about. There was a sort of version A and a version B. I knew, or it was pretty clear that Muse and Mayor Fisk were part of version A, but I didn't know they were part of version B explicitly for sure until I was asked to be the legal consultant on season 2.
Mm.
Interesting.
I was the person who came in and, like, you know, was the legal consultant on season 2.
How wild. Your world's like really
really converging. Yeah, that's nuts.
It was awesome. I was the legal consultant for the She-Hulk television show too.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
A Marvel exec who moved from the publishing side to the Hollywood side, Sana Amana.
Yep.
Who I'm sure you remember, Heather. And so she brought me in as a consultant on the She-Hulk show, which is run by Jessica Gao, which is fantastic. And then she was like, do you want to come, you know, chat with us a bit about some of the legal elements in season 2, just to kind of, you know, lock some things down a little bit. And so I was thrilled to do that. And as part of that, they sent me all the scripts. Actually, they sent me all the episodes of like early cuts of all the episodes of season 1. So
a version B, you mean?
Yeah, a version B, correct.
Got it.
And so I watched it all and but in my first meeting, I was like, so, you know, is it like, just, I asked to confirm, you know, is it actually Muse? Is it actually Mayor Fisk? They're like, yeah, man, of course it is. Yes, it is. So that was my first look at it. And I
You know, it was, I'm trying to think about what that felt like emotionally, because I created Muse and that run with Ron mm-hmm. Garney, who is one of, who's a very close friend now. He's an incredible, astonishing artist.
Mm-hmm.
He's been at Marvel for a long time and done some really powerful runs on like Captain America and done some Hulk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But our Daredevil run, I think he and I both really felt we had something to prove, because he felt correctly that he had adjusted his style and leveled up to this really cool new place and what he could do artistically. And I'm a former lawyer, right? So if I'm not getting Daredevil right, then it's a problem. And so we really dug in and wanted to, I always want to do new and interesting things whenever I take on a run with a kind of a storied character. And Muse was something that we both knew from the beginning was gonna work in the comic, because it was Ron's design, his the way he interpreted what I asked for, which is the serial killer artist, and like the way we talked about it, and then the things that Muse did, we just really thought we had something there, and then Mayor Fisk was just like the story engine that opened up with Kingpin controlling the entire city. Like, that went on for years after I ended my run on Daredevil. It became a big part of the Marvel Universe.
Chip continued that, right?
Chip continued
it too. Yeah, yeah.
It was a big part of Spider-Man.
Right.
It was just the status quo in the Marvel Universe for a very long time. Like, I don't think it went away until 2022 or 20. Like, I came up with it in 2015, and then it lasted for like a very, very, like in a really, really long time, which is, you know, the Marvel Universe churns just like the DC Universe does. And so to have a status quo element stay that long felt great. And then to have those two elements be adapted this quickly into the television program, which, you know, normally it takes a long time. And I guess, you know, it Muse appeared, I think, in 2016. And then, you know, so technically it was 9 years, but like it doesn't feel like a long time for the normal amount of time it takes for stories to be adapted into things. So it was hugely gratifying, especially the care they took with the design and the Ron and I both went to the set. And so we saw the prop masters took us around and they showed us Muse's lair and like everything they had designed and how careful they were to adhere to the things that we had laid out in the comic, which isn't always the case, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They treated us with immense respect as comic creators. As creators, comic creators is maybe not even the term I think, just like artists, you know, as people who had made something that was powerful enough to be adapted into another medium this way. So you do that, then you go to the premiere and you like go to the party and you're like hanging out with Vincent D'Onofrio and Charlie Cox. And it felt very Hollywood. We felt very like, you know, fancy suit, the whole thing. And it was amazing. And now at New York Comic Con this past weekend, I saw, I don't know, six Muses, like a mm-hmm. lot, which is a little, you know, Muse is not a nice guy. So it's an interesting thing to be embraced that way. But it's obviously a super cool design, and I'm not surprised to see people cosplaying it.
You know what I love most about, I think, the Mayor Fisk arc is this moment where if the Mayor Fisk arc would have happened in the 80s, like if Frank Miller would have done it, then I feel like it definitely would have been Kingpin rigged the election. In fact, he did try to rig a mayoral election during mm-hmm. Frank Miller's run. But in your run, you phrase it like that's assumed by Matt, and Kingpin did try to rig it, but it turns out he won. And that, to me, just said volumes for how people are reacting to superheroes in New York and in the Marvel Universe. When you constructed that story, how much did you take into account things that had happened in the universe or how people actually felt toward vigilantes? Was that a part of the consideration, or was it more a reflection of the real world?
Well, it's both, right? You know, you want to write a story that is resonant. But that was something that I, like, the wind was blowing in a certain way in this country around the time that story was being constructed. And it felt like something that would be plausible to me. You always want to find the most dramatic way to end a story or to build a story, right? Because the way one story ends in comics needs to build the next one, right? So you end up with a situation where, you know, Matt is just convinced that the Kingpin has rigged the election. That's the only way he possibly could have won. And what's the more dramatic ending for a character like Daredevil, who is the defender of justice in the city, is to be faced with the fact that, like, no, this is what the people wanted. This is the New York they wanted. This is the version people chose. And
you know, you can look at that all from all kinds of different directions. But the direction that we chose to look at it, chose to examine it through, was Matt's reaction to it, Matt Murdock's reaction to it. And he, to him, it's unthinkable. It's the devil is has become the mayor of New York City. And so how does he adapt to understanding that the New York he loves and has defended and has fought, you know, fought for his whole adult life, maybe isn't quite the New York that he thought it was, at least at that time. You know, cities can change, people can change.
Well, and Matt's so tied to the city of New York. You know, mm-hmm. he often visually blends in with the city, you know, as Daredevil. So it's interesting to see his heart ripped and changed. Like what you did with him during that run, especially when he's forced to work with Kingpin and these different yep. things because of his position of authority, was just genius. You did a great job, you and Art, challenging him in those other ways. It was a truly historic run. And I'm telling you, from a Daredevil perspective, having a historic run on that character is not easy because you joined a murderer's row of some of the greats of all time.
Yeah, there, absolutely. So. I mean, it's just, I mentioned Swamp Thing earlier. Like, I came out of Swamp Thing after Scott Snyder, who's a good friend of mine. But, you know, you look at the list of talent that's done that book, and it's everyone from Brian K. Vaughan to Alan Moore to, you know, Len Wein. Like, just it's killers all the way down in a good way. And that was my first, literally my first big two assignment at all ever after coming up through the sort of the salt mines of indie comics of you know, barely there but important indie comics, to be given a shot at that title was really, like, scary. But I also thought, like what I said with the Star Wars stuff, like when you get these opportunities, you want to be able to walk away with your head held high, even if it's not something that people connected with or didn't give you another opportunity. So my feeling with that was, if I'm going to write Swamp Thing and what I write is going to stand next to every other Swamp Thing story that's ever been told, and if it works and I get more work, great. If I don't, at least I'll know that I did it, and it'll always be something that is part of my story. And I've really have tried to take that attitude into everything I've done, and that includes Daredevil. So as you said, I was following up Mark Waid, who had a legendary, like, mega Eisner nominated, many winning run with Chris Somney. And that was after you had Brubaker, you had Bendis, you had mm-hmm. Kevin Smith, you had
Bob Gale, did a short run in that run too. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. You know, you had, Ann Nesenti, you had obviously yep. Frank Miller, yeah. You had, you know, Stan Lee at the beginning. Like, it was a truly, like, a big one. And when you add on the fact that there are expectations with it, because I'm a former attorney, like, how do I do it in a way that's going to, like, do justice to the fact that people have expectations of it? How am I going to write Matt as a lawyer? Because I wanted to. I'm the first and so far only attorney who's ever written that character. And so I had to get it right. Like, other lawyers were going to give me, you know, shit about it if I didn't get it right. But I also didn't want it to make it a courtroom book, because that's really not what Daredevil is.
It's not a fun comic.
No,
to,
not.
Yeah.
you can have an arc. You can have a scene. Like, there's a whole arc where he goes to the Supreme Court in my run, which was really important for me to get right. And I'm very, very proud of that arc. The political stuff in the Mayor Fisk arc is all very, like, legally and lawyer adjacent. So I had to get all that stuff right, but it was also really important to do the ninja flipping around on rooftop stuff correctly.
I'm now imagining a Daredevil arc where he's discussing Mens Rea with Foggy and just, you know.
That stuff has a place in Daredevil, which is kind of
no,
cool.
No, for sure.
But it's not, you know, like,
it's not what the story
right,
is.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard, you know, to do right.
It's interesting. The comic book was so legally accurate, but in the show, Wilson Fisk declares martial law, which is not a power the mayor of New York has ever had. So I like that you were very, very active. I'm not criticizing the show, and but it is funny that, like, there were certain legal liberties taken in that show that you apparently decided to not, you know, to actually uphold the actual law. So congratulations.
Well, I spoke to people at City Hall, or former people who had worked at City Hall, because I really wanted to understand the mayor and what the mayor's capable of, and there's a truism that the mayor of New York is the second most powerful elected position in the country, and which is really something to think about, right? You know, is that legit? Is it not legit? Whatever. But part of the reason for that is that the state constitution, the city charter, like the documents that define the mayor's power are extremely loosey-goosey. And basically, the mayor, the declaration of martial law is not something that's enumerated, but it's also not necessarily like the police force is his. He can tell them what to do and they have to do it, generally speaking. So martial law in the classic sense of bringing in the National Guard and all of that stuff, you know, arguably no, but using the police force in that way, arguably yes. And so it's the governor's job to rein in the mayor if that is something that seems important. But as we, you know, again, not to talk about recent political stuff, but, you know, like in New York City recently, we've seen that there are political considerations that make it difficult for the governor to always choose to exercise the powers that they have to rein in the mayor.
I never knew that.
Not to make this a politics podcast, but now I'm like, okay, if the mayor of New York is the second most powerfully elected person, but the governor has authority over the mayor, like that's a weird
it is and
it's a super weird
what you see is that, you know, there are just there are checks and balances that are enumerated within the documents and the law. There are also checks and balances that are not. And those are things like influence and network and what's going to happen if I actually exercise the power that the law gives me. What are the consequences to that, to me personally and to the people I represent, all of those things. And so it's this crazy enmeshed network of of decision making where there almost is no easy decision ever, especially when you're going to be in conflict with other powerful politicians. So, you know.
Speaking of exercising that power and consequences of exercising that power, She-Hulk is another book that you worked on. And we're finding out here, we're also the legal consultant on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think like it was only a natural progression for you to eventually end up at Daredevil, having written the other lawyer Marvel character.
Right. Exactly.
You know, there's a moment in She-Hulk. One of our contributors, Mike Mazzella, pointed this out in a social that we did once. And maybe you don't remember this moment. If you don't, we'll skip right past it. Where Jen is on trial for the copyright of her name and Mallory is serving as her attorney. But there's a moment where she asks an extra question to one of the guys she was dating. Like, what did you want to date, Jen or She-Hulk? Right. Mm-hmm. And he says She-Hulk. And our lawyer friend, Mike, pointed out, we call him Doug's lawyer on the show, pointed out she didn't have to ask that question. There was no legal reason for her to ask that question. She did that to mess with Jen. I was wondering if you were part of that decision, or if they ran that by you legally, or if you had any influence on that.
Well, this is a while ago at this point, and the way that this job works, or that job works, is you get scripts and you give notes on them, and then maybe you get a second or a third draft of them and you give notes on them too. But ultimately, I'm not the arbiter of what actually makes it into the episode, and so you find out what made it into the episode when you see it. And sometimes you remember specifically, oh yeah, we talked about that. I remember that that's there. Like the conflict waivers, there was a big discussion about conflict waivers, and that's, you know, that I'm like, that was because we talked about it. That's why those are there. But that particular moment, I don't remember. It might've been something that we talked about at some point, but you know, I really just big picture. I really enjoyed what Jessica and her team did on that show. I think it was, and Tatiana obviously played the role to perfection.
She was great.
Yeah, I really thought it was fun. I was very excited to be part of it. I thought they did, you know, She-Hulk is weird, right? Like the way that She-Hulk's publication history has worked is, let me rephrase, the way the character operates within Marvel Universe is weird. Like She-Hulk is one of the few fourth wall breaking characters regularly, which means she'll look at the camera and say whatever she feels like saying. Speaking directly to the reader, Deadpool does it too.
Literally ripping the comic page to skip ahead in time.
Yeah, like she doesn't seem quite as bound by the typical rules of comic book stuff. And some runs really lean into that, others don't. I was sort of in between. Like John Byrne's run really leaned into it. Dan Slott's run, maybe a little bit less so. Mariko Tamaki's run quite a bit out. But like it, you know, she's unusual in the way she operates on the comic book page. And I thought the show did a pretty good job of a very good job of adapting that element of her character into the TV show. It was cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I hope we get to see her again. I know there's not any plans right now, but post this MCU reset, who knows what we're going to see, but we know we're getting more Daredevil Born Again.
Yes.
They've already confirmed season 3, which I'm pretty excited about. And I saw the trailer for season 2.
Yep.
Looks great. Can't wait to cover it here on the channel. Heather, should we move on to Hear Me Out?
I think so. I think we should.
I think it's about that time. The segment where we will say whatever kind of, you know, theory, controversial opinions, thoughts we have. So Heather, do you want to go first?
All right. So I chose this one specifically because Charles is on this show. In our time working on Star Wars together, you developed a lot of Emperor Palpatine and his relationship with, you know, with Anakin. It was one of my favorite things about working with you on those books. And my hot take this week is I think Emperor Palpatine was the most honest politician in the galaxy.
Hmm. Okay.
People think of him as, you know, the ultimate liar. But if you look closer, he's actually one of the few political figures whose actions perfectly matched his goals.
Is that because he also, he believed the lie that the Jedi were evil? And well, then again, he did say the Jedi tried to overthrow me, which is true. Yep.
He always wanted control. He never pretended otherwise. Hold on, I made notes. He never claimed to be a moral paragon. And he kept his promises to his constituents.
He said he would lay down the powers, though, after the crisis was averted. Is that because the crisis never ended?
Not in his mind.
Okay. All right, all right. So it's like George Costanza. It's only a lie if you believe it's a lie.
But he promised to end corruption in the Senate. He did. He promised peace
by ending the Senate. Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, all right.
The Clone Wars ended. He promised safety from separatists and Jedi traitors. He eliminated all of them.
Mm-hmm.
True.
He promised strength, and the Empire became the most powerful regime in the galaxy. So, you know, he by default is the most honest politician in the Star Wars history.
And that's why I'm glad somehow he returned. Charles, what's your take on Heather's analysis?
Palpatine is one of my favorite characters in all of Star Wars, and if not my favorite character, and I've said that in many interviews in the past, and I mean it. I think he's extraordinary in terms of what he was going up. Like, when you think of the Sith rule of two, like, how could the Sith actually be effective if there's ever only two? Like, how could they fight against a Jedi Order that is, you know, 5,000 times as big as they are, and so on and so forth. And I think Palpatine's glory is that he was actually able to do it. Like, he methodically and meticulously, over what sure seems like generations, figured out how to do what he was going to do. Was he honest? I don't know. I mean, I think he was very much able to live within sort of the shadow of the truth. Like, you think about that conversation he has with Anakin, in the opera, the Mon Calamari opera in episode 3. I mean, he's real big on lying by omission. He says things that are true, but there's absolutely a lot of information there that isn't going to be provided. And so you really have to look at what he says and really look at it carefully, because, you know, as Heather pointed out, he did end corruption in the Senate, but he did it by destroying democracy, right? You can't have a corrupt Senate if there is no Senate. And so you know, it's pretty slick. He's a slick operator. There's no question about it.
The Bill Clinton of the Star Wars universe. Oh, slick sheath. At it again.
Something else. And I think, you know, there's this tendency when you're talking about Star Wars in particular, or really any fictional universe, to talk about these characters like they're real. Palpatine does not exist. He's a fictional character. However, he's one of those characters. Hannibal Lecter is another good example. Like, you as a writer, you are inspired to bring your absolute A++ game to writing his choices, his dialogue, the way he occupies a scene, because he's got to play a certain role within the scene and the Star Wars galaxy. And so writers over the decades have really risen to that challenge. And that includes from George Lucas down to, you know, to me, whatever. And you end up with this really consistently, like, evil in a very specifically powerful way that I think is a real reflection of the way evil actually works in our galaxy. And I think that's part of why he's so awesome.
All right, I think we got to leave it there. I got to hear me out, but I'll keep it for next week. Heather, it's been fantastic talking to you. Charles, thank you so much for coming on. I can't believe I got to geek out with you about your own work and hopefully embarrass you a little bit.
I appreciate it.
I mean, it's just fantastic to have you on, meet you face to face and everything. Heather, Thank you. If you want to, you can subscribe to the Screen Crush Crossover Universe podcast on all podcast platforms. You can talk about it on our free-to-join Discord server, or you can find us on YouTube, where we'll have various snippets and other videos that you can watch all the time relating to Charles' work and the various things that he has created. And if it's your first time here, I beg of you, please subscribe and smash that bell for alerts. I am with Heather Antos.
And I'm with Ryan Airy.
See you guys next time.